death to the bad man. With a gun and a knife and a waistband. With the war with the devil and Shaitan. He wore a bad toupee and a spray tan. So high now, hoping that I land. On a tie stick, moving through Thailand. On the radio, heard a plane hijack. Government being that.
Welcome to another episode of the Lookout Landing podcast. I am, as ever, your managing editor of Lookout Landing, Kate Prusser. Joining me today, as ever, is my co-host, the mellifluously voiced, very good-haired, tall, strong, kind, John Troopin. John.
Hello, Kate. Thank you for the wonderful dating profile. I appreciate it immensely.
Yes, how exactly. Ladies. Goodness.
No. How are you doing, Kate?
I have been better, to be frank. I like to start these things off on a positive note, which is why I spent a lot of time singing your praises there. Also because you are, you know, very supportive and good friend of mine. And yeah, things have been a little bit of a struggle. My cat got super attacked yesterday. Jeez.
Do we know by what creature?
No, do we have a
posse that we can corral?
Apparently the perp, according to the very kind vet that I talked to, says that it's another cat. So okay. Yeah, I'm gonna. Right.
So but this I is just... more of a. This could be more of like a Disney movie of like, you know, the bully on the block that we, you know, need to find a wise older cat to teach this one some, you know, some neat moves, and then defeat the mean older cat in sort of a dance off or some other sort of
maybe
thing.
A Disney movie that's directed by Tarantino. Like, you do not see my cat's arm. It's gory in there.
It'd be a new direction.
Yeah, this is a gritty Disney reboot of the Fox indeed. And the Hound.
Indeed, yeah. Allie and AJ instead. Allie and AK-47.
Oh my gosh. There's like two people out there who are going to get that joke and appreciate you for it. So.
Very pleased.
To those of you listening, the two of you, there
you're,
it is
you're
for
welcome.
You. Exactly. All right, so we are a week into the season, so mm-hmm. more or less, right? We are... Mm-hmm. We are four games in, and a lot has happened since we last recorded. Drew Smyly went on the DL, which sucks.
Mm-hmm.
So that happened, and then some other not-so-great stuff happened during our opener at Houston.
Indeed. It was an unpleasant opening stretch. I think in ways that we were not expecting, though, which was interesting. You know, we had expected that the pitching staff would struggle, especially in Houston, in the you know peanut box, the pine box that they call a stadium down there.
Pine box. Were you going for coffin imagery there on purpose?
It felt like it. Felt like it. And yet, you know, Felix looked good. Felix gave us a little scare, but Felix looked good, and he should be on schedule. He says he's on schedule, and the Mariners say he's on schedule to start again, so I don't feel like we need to be too concerned there as long as he looks okay on Saturday. But, you know, Iwakuma looked good with his 87-mile-per-hour fastballs. God bless him. You know, Paxton looked dominant. The bullpen looked good when they weren't, you know, up through the 13th inning, at which point I don't know really what you can ask of your bullpen, you know. And even then, Chase DeJong, you know, poor guy, did a pretty good job, got weak contact and got a fly ball that literally would have been a fly out at every other baseball stadium except for in Houston. So
and shout out to that kid who is super composed after after that tough loss. And you know what a what a way to make your MLB debut and have that happen.
Yeah, it was tough.
In his post game interview, he was just really focused on, "Hey, I made my MLB debut. How cool is that?" So I mean, I think that there's a lot of resiliency in him, and that's a good mental place to be.
Sure.
And I'm definitely looking forward to seeing him at Tacoma this year.
Absolutely.
And hopefully not up again with us for a while.
Hopefully, the staff will heal to the point that he has the time to continue improving. How about that?
Yeah, and we still haven't seen Dylan Overton, too. Mm-mm. So we've got that.
Absolutely. Well, and even that feeds into last night's game where, you know, Ariel Miranda continued, you know, his deal with the FIP gods that, sure, you can just give up home runs whenever you want. You can walk people occasionally. You know, I think he's on the late Wade LeBlanc plan of we're just going to completely neglect how, you know, your peripherals look, and you're just going to narrowly make it through five innings with two runs every time. So,
at some point, is it? I mean, with him, it's terrifying because you are kind of waiting for that other shoe to drop as mm-hmm. far as the peripherals catching up with him. Mm-hmm. But also, he has such a limited amount of major league experience. Is there a possibility that he could reset his peripherals in some way?
It's certainly, I mean, we've seen that he has that extra gear on his fastball. He has a truly excellent changeup, and his sort of slider curveball is not exceptional, but it's passable. I think getting that pitch up to the level that, you know, you would like to see a third pitch from a starting pitcher be, I think, is the next important step for him. But, you know, there's two ways to look at it. One is, yeah, he got lucky. You know, he gave up two homers, three walks, and five hits, and only gave up two runs. The other is, he was a lefty going against the, you know, lineup of Springer, Altuve, mm-hmm. Correa, Gattis, and, you know, Beltran, Bregman, etc. And he only gave up two runs, you know, and there are going to be better, you know, there are going to be better starts for him purely because not every game is going to be started against the team that is as good as the Astros mm-hmm. are. And I think you and I talked about this, you know, while watching these games. If there was, you know, there were a lot of interesting takeaways. I think it's clear that a big takeaway from this is Houston is as good as we thought they would be.
I think they're better, honestly, because, mm-hmm. you know, I was terrified of the lineup, obviously, going into the season. But I comforted myself with the idea that the pitching might not be that great. And maybe Keuchel isn't Keuchel. And, oh, Keuchel's Keuchel again. Great. and then maybe the bullpen isn't. Well, the bullpen is terrifying. I mean, it is just one. And I knew Devinsky was good. He's kind of been on my radar since last year. Mm-hmm. So I'm not surprised to see him just kind of out there dominating. But, yeah. Wow, that is a tough assignment. Mm-hmm. To face Gregerson, Devinsky,
and Giles, and
Giles.
Yeah, and well, and I think that sort of gets to a point of not only are they very good, but they're sort of a nightmare matchup for the Mariners. You know, their pitching staff is formulated around their starting rotation in particular, a series of guys with excellent breaking pitches, and the Mariners have a bunch of hitters who demolish fastballs and do a really good job on changeups too. But other than, I think it was Robinson Cano and Nelson Cruz, none of the Mariners hitters really did anything positive last year against curveballs or sliders. And Gene Segura, one of the reasons, you know, I've written about this and we've talked about this, but one of the things that I love about him, and I think everyone saw, even just in that series, is he has historically been a great hitter of off-speed pitches, and he had a lot of success this series, and the rest of the Mariners did not. And I think that's, you know, part of that is just bad swings, not great at-bats, but a lot of that is they're just very poorly matched to beat the Astros, and there are not many teams in the league, thankfully, with a pitching staff as specifically targeted against the Mariners as they are.
Yeah, it feels a little bit like a cruel joke in some ways. But to get back to Segura, I am prepared to just declare the trade a win at this point. I mean, mm-hmm. how much, if only for the very fantastic shot we got of him kind of reclining.
I was gonna say, that could be, that is in the running for a new, you know, if we ever, if the Lookout Landing logo ever changes, that is a solid outline. You know, I don't see Sexton leaving ever, you know, or in the near future, but man, that is a fantastic image.
Already, I mean, I knew he was going to provide some highly gif-able moments, but that was just to have that right off the bat. Mm. And then, I mean, do we win that game without him last night? The one game that we managed to take out of the series? And he tried to help us win the other one, too. They just kind of gave it away there.
For sure. No, it was encouraging to see. I mean, you know, a lot of these things, you know, you don't see much stabilization at, you know, this stage in the season. But it's pleasant to see some of the traits that we looked at this off season and said, this should be good. This is what this person should be able to do. You know, actualize, you know, it's good to see Segura making contact at a extremely high rate and being really good at hitting off speed pitches. It's really nice to see Haniger get on base at an extremely high rate, you know, having an on base percentage currently 200 points higher than his batting average, which on the one hand, not a fantastic batting average obviously, but that's the whole point, right? That you don't need to actually hit that often if you have that plate discipline. And you know, seeing Dyson, you know, showcase his extraordinary lack of power, yes, but also showcase that all he needs is a little bit of space to get on base, and he's going to, you know, turn a line drive, like a casual line drive to right field into a double, you know, like he did in the first game, I think, mm-hmm. in the ninth inning, and, you know, he'll get from first to third. He'll take an extra base. You know, Segura stole a base. Haniger stole a base. And so those sorts of positives that we talked about were really exciting to see.
It is really fun to watch Dyson fly around the bases. And it is equally fun, if not maybe more so, to watch him glide around left field.
Absolutely.
And oh my gosh, that outfield just...
It's a good start.
It's only going to look better, right? When mm-hmm. they're outside of that teeny tiny little nightmare stadium.
Absolutely. So, obviously, we've spoken a lot about things that are good or things that we got by on. What were some of the things that most worried you so far out of this initial series and looking forward? Is there a single player? Is there a general activity that's got you down?
I am really depressed about the inability to string together just like two hits in a row. Two base runners in a row. And then when we did get the bases full, I mean, it was shades of those 2015 Mariners who would, or even I think we had this problem in 2016 too, load up the bases and then a fart noise. Right? Like, yeah. that was really hard to watch.
The shift in the order from, you have the top of the order that is very solid at, you know, Segura makes a lot of contact, Haniger, you know, gets on base a lot. Obviously, you know, Cano and Cruz did not look good at all. And
oh my God, Cruz looked terrible. Yeah, I keep telling myself it's gonna, you know, it's gonna even out. But man, I was so high on him after just watching him rake in the WBC and in spring training to some. And he's got this power swing, and he's just gonna. I can't believe he didn't crush anything out of that dumb little stadium. He just chased so many bad balls.
Yeah, and I think that will come. You know, we've seen them be successful for long enough that I think they deserve the benefit of the doubt, perhaps more so than Danny Valencia.
Oh, man. He talk about some bad at-bats. Yeah, he had some really, really rough at-bats.
Yeah. And I think, you know, again, one of the things, you know, I would say my biggest concern was Valencia because, you know, hitting with runners in scoring position, hitting, you know, cluster luck, those sorts of things, that sorts itself out. Valencia's swing looks bad. And not in the just the, like, oh, he's being fooled kind of way. He's got this weird kick out that he's doing at the end of each swing with his back leg that I went back and looked at film of his 2014 and 2015 and 2016, and I'd never seen him do that really before. So I don't know if that's a conscious thing or if that's just happened a few times, but especially since the team wants to give Daniel Vogelbach time to get fully right, whatever that may mean.
I wonder if they're trying to put... I'm sorry, this is just an aside, but I wonder if they're trying to put Vogelbach a little bit on the Paxton, you got to earn your way back and have it mean something, and that... And the Zunino as well, that pathway. And I think I even saw that referenced a couple of times. When I was in Tacoma watching batting practice, Vogelbach was hitting angry. He was just stinging. And I mean, this was a super casual, everybody just meet, it's media day, goofing around. And Vogelbach is in there making baseballs regret their existence.
Well, and he needs to watch his spot because there's a long-haired... you know, Slylock Fox coming for him from the outfield, isn't there?
That is true. I also saw Ben Gamel getting some reps at first base, which was, I don't know if it was just a batting practice thing or what. It was, if they're trying to make Ben Gamel into a utility player, I have no idea, but it was strange.
Intriguing, to be sure.
Definitely. But yeah, I think I was really disappointed that Tacoma was rained out last night. I'm so curious to watch the Rainiers. And I think I'm just very interested to see what Vogelbach does and how soon. I think he definitely is going to be back with us, but how soon does that happen?
I think Valencia can't continue to be as rough as he has, and you know, I say that in can't meaning the mathematical sense, not in a physical sense, because yeah, he really could, I suppose. if he keeps swinging like the way he does, it's not going to improve, but you know, I suspect he will still figure it out, at least to some degree, and if they really need it, you know, they can bring up DJ Peterson, they can bring up, you know, Vogelbach, or if they, you know, want to, they can look for someone in free agency. They, you know, are a few hitters around veterans, you know, James Loney, or, you know, a variety of sort of aging first basemen that you can plug in, but that would be, I think, a little bit reactionary at this point.
Oh, definitely. And also,
I mean, certainly at this point, but I think by the end of the month, we'll have a good sense of whether this is an issue or whether it's just a bad first week.
Let's also point out, though, that there are not a lot of first basemen in the league who handle that double play ball off the bat of Altuve that got Miranda out of a bases loaded jam, which such a smart all around play with Seager scooping, getting the force at home, and then that quick relay to Valencia. It is really nice to have an athletic, semi-athletic.
That was
baseman.
The jankiest looking double play I have seen in a while. See, like Seager bob, like first off, Miranda throws a extraordinary changeup, and Altuve, who looked awful really this entire series, one of the only, you know, things I think we can feel really fortunate about that series, but you know, he was kept off balance with a lot of good low off speed, but you know, Seager double clutches, lasers to Ruiz is standing goofy footed on the plate for some reason, has to fully rotate, fires a ball that probably is over the head of a lot of first basemen. Valencia, you know, uses the bag like a diving board to bounce up into the air and snag it. And Altuve thankfully fell out of the batter's box. Like,
yes.
This is
none of that happens without Altuve falling out of the batter's box.
Yeah, you know, it's a razor's edge there that they lived on. And you know, obviously they won by a couple runs, so you can look back and say, well, we could have still gotten out of it. But, you know, that was one of those points where it's like, we look back on this game like, oh, how nice. But, you know, there was a lot of, just as much as there was playing with fire by the Mariners, you know, there was playing, you know, the Astros played with fire. And in fairness, the Astros, I think, also were something like 3 or 4 for 25 with runners in scoring position. So,
well, a huge part of that was the dominance of the bullpen, who we should maybe, I know that we're sort of talking about things that we're concerned about, but, ooh, boy, can't be too concerned about the bullpen because they just, I feel a lot better about the health of our pitching rotation with having seen pretty much every member of that bullpen. And I must apologize to Casey Fien, who I did not think was Fien, but turns out to be Fien.
Indeed. And, well, and he's, I think an encouraging thing was also seeing, even in that 13 inning game, you know, and really all series, we saw multiple guys go multiple innings, which you don't want to see a lot. But we saw Altavilla, I think, went 2 innings and was lights out in one of the games. Edwin Diaz went 2 innings, was his usual brilliant self. James Pazos last night was excellent, and you know, looked exactly like the guy that, you know, he can be if he's got a general idea of where the ball's going.
Which can we say too, like, lately, and I mean, I really started noticing this towards the end of spring training, but after he came in towards the beginning of spring training and was just crazy wild all over the place, I was like, I hate this trade. I continue to hate this trade. I know why we made that trade, but Littell looked so good, and he is so wild. But then it just seemed to creep towards getting better and better and better.
Mm-hmm.
And I think his command has improved every time I've seen him.
It's been really nice to see, and I think having him as a lefty who is not limited by splits, by, you know, handedness splits, is a really wonderful element for them to have. His K numbers are outrageous, to say the least, and he seems to be picking up right there. So
do you have any theories about what that increased command, like, what do you think is going on with him?
I haven't watched him enough in terms of looking back this season at his motion versus in years past, but when we first acquired him, you know, this was a guy who had a El Duque leg kick when he was in college, and he has been slowly working at every stage of his progression into a more traditional motion. So you can watch his motion, you know, there are clips of him from early minors where he still has this herky-jerky kind of motion, and he's very sidearm, and that slider is just as devastating, but it's going anywhere. and, you know, you can see him in AAA with the Yankees and in the majors with the Yankees, and it's a little more composed. So I think it seems, when I watch him, he doesn't look anything... nothing stands out, which sounds like a cop-out a little bit, but compared to his previous motions and previous iterations of his motions, where it was like, you would watch him and you say, that is a huge guy with 18 different parts of his body going different directions. And now it's like, oh, this guy looks like a pitcher. And wow, does he throw hard. And wow, does that, you know, sinker move. And oh, that slider
is unfair. How tall is he again?
He's a big guy. I want to say he's a little bit over 6 foot. He is 6'2". Yeah, he's 6'2", 235. So as a big, big man.
That's a lot of downward plane coming at you.
Yeah, and a lot of frownward plane.
he's a slightly less tall wall. Slightly less tall wall.
Exactly. Well, I don't understand what it is about being named James Pa or James Pa on this team that makes you incapable of smiling. But
and left-handed.
Indeed. And
large.
Absolutely dirty. yeah, but...
Maybe that's it. Maybe it's just being in proximity to the other James Pa. He got some of that James Pa power.
Well, we talked about that when we first acquired him because he was such a strange acquisition, just in terms of what the stated mentality had been for this organization, right? Is that, mm-hmm. Oh, we're going to find guys who throw lots of strikes, who control the zone, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, even the electric players that we've had, you know, Altavilla and Diaz, you know, these are guys who have had extremely low walk rates their entire careers and have continued to do that. And Pazos was a guy who really, you know, his biggest issue was he would strike out 10 guys a game and walk 5 or yeah. something, you know, it was like, and I think it seems likely that they saw something in his motion that they thought, oh, we can fix this, or oh, you know, this is something we can work with, which is very much what they did with James Paxton. You know, James Paxton was this elite pitcher who never could fully access his talent because he was unable to locate the ball. And last year we saw him come back, and suddenly he's throwing the ball in the strike zone the same amount as Hisashi Iwakuma, and he's one of the best pitchers in the American League. And if there is a similar adjustment that they were able to make with Pazos, and you know, this is very speculative, obviously, but it doesn't feel like that large of a leap to say that they saw a similar adjustment that they could make. And so far, you know, since he's been in a Mariner uniform, it seems like his improvement has been a success. It has been successful so far. How about that? We need to see more of that, but it's exciting to have him already performing at the major league level, because I thought he was going to be in AAA to start the season.
Oh, for sure. I thought that. So yeah. That's...
Yeah.
An unexpected boon.
Absolutely. So do you have any other thoughts on the Houston series before we take a break and then go to some Twitter questions?
I think I don't want to let them off the hook too easily because
the Mariners.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely.
Because as it's been pointed out, yeah, sure, it was annoying that a lot of those balls hit out wouldn't have been home runs at other ballparks, but we had equal opportunity to do that, right?
So, very much so.
I mean, the Mariners played in the same stadium.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think sort of examining what you pointed out about how the Mariners are not very good at hitting breaking balls, and Houston mm-hmm. happens to have a staff that throws a ton of them, really yeah. good ones.
Yeah.
And then that sort of combined with, oh man, Springer and his WRC plus is like 300 right now.
Something like that.
Yeah, like
296.
Top 10 in all of baseball. I mean, he might have had a hot series. He might be on his way to a career year. But what's terrifying about him is he's sort of late. I always thought of him as a huge strikeout guy who would just mm-hmm. chase anything. But he really showed some scary plate discipline
mm-hmm.
in that game and was able to really punish some... I mean, the pitch Miranda made to him was really bad.
Sure.
It's just, that was a flat-out bad pitch. But, yeah, he really put together some smart at-bats, which is
mm-hmm.
annoying. Incredibly
Absolutely.
Annoying. So,
I think...
Oh, go ahead.
Just your point about the way that these teams are constructed. The Mariners, we think, and you know, this organization is betting on, are perfectly constructed, or as perfectly as they could make it constructed to succeed in Safeco. The Astros are perfectly constructed to succeed in Minute Maid Park. They have a bunch of righty power hitters that can just flick fly balls into the Crawford boxes, and it's tough to beat them when you have a bunch of pitchers who are centered around getting contact and getting fly balls.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's going to be a challenge. And so it is frustrating that we started 1-3. It is frustrating that we had so many opportunities to score. You know, I think we had 3-4 different times this series where we had the bases loaded with nobody out and got one run each time. You know, that's awful. And that isn't, you know, you're not going to be a competitive team. You're not going to be a playoff team if you're doing that. It's just that simple. And, you know, these are also, you know, the hitters that have been struggling are good hitters. You know, if Robinson Cano is not a good hitter anymore, this team isn't going to go to the playoffs. Like, I don't know what to say. Like, if Robinson Cano and Nelson Cruz aren't good, like, that's sort of the game. Like, you know, if our good players aren't good, like, you know, we love Mitch Haniger. We're very optimistic about Gene Segura. Ariel Miranda could be just as good as Drew Smiley. It's not going to make much of a difference if Robinson Cano and Nelson Cruz aren't good. So, you know, I think I agree with you. Like, we're obviously very optimistic about it, but only, you know, we recognize that this isn't going to cut it. There's just, you know, there are ways to get around some issues on this roster. If the best players on our team aren't good,
there's no way to get around that.
Yeah, there's nothing to be done. So,
which luckily is, as far as outcomes go, is it probable that they'll regress some? Yes. Is it probable that they will just, I don't know, get bonked on the head with flower pots and forget how to hit entirely? No. So.
Mm-hmm.
It'll come around, but it was certainly hard to watch. I'll be really interested to see when they come to our house how Houston stacks up against us in our own ballpark. Because I think that'll give us a better idea of the true talent measure of this team.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
All right. Well, that seems like a good place to maybe take a little break. And when we come back, we will answer your Twitter questions.
Sounds good.
Alright, now's the time in the show where we answer your Twitter questions. So thank you very much to those of you who submitted them. And what have we got this week, John?
We've got an excellent crop here, starting with the most important question. I don't know if anyone, especially if you're on Twitter, you almost certainly saw this. If not, perhaps it slipped by you. But an excellent question from Henry. At the boy Henry J on Twitter, will the Grasshoppers actually be good? Now, in case you missed this spectacular development, Safeco Field has announced a series of new food services that they will be doing. A lot of it looks excellent. Kate, I know you were pointing out something about frozen
Rita's Italian ice.
Yes,
I used to eat it all the time in Philadelphia. Super refreshing. It's like if. Sometimes ice cream is not super refreshing to me on a hot day, but water ice is, or as you call it in Philadelphia, water ice. Which
so on a scale, so like how is it almost as good as Dippin' Dots? Is it like nearly Dippin' Dots? Is it not quite Dippin' Dots? What's the scale?
I've never had Dippin' Dots because the idea repulses me.
What?
Disgusting.
How have you been to a Mariners
horrible.
Game and not had to just like purely out of fascination eat some Dippin' Dots?
Well, I'm certainly not spending my own money on the Dumpin' Dots. I just call them
Dumpin' Dots. All right, well, good, good, good. This is good. An excellent start. Anyways, the point is, among the offerings is toasted grasshoppers.
What is the word for it? There's like a Spanish word for it because they're going to be in Edgar's Cantina. I want to say chicharrones, but that's not right. It's
let's see.
Like pork rinds.
I'm not entirely certain. Let's see. They're Oaxacan grasshoppers, which I don't think is particularly the term, but they do look kind of delicious, to be honest. They kind of look like crawfish, and I'm pretty excited about it. I think you can get them. They're $4 for a bowl, which is not bad at all. Tossed in chili lime salt. You sound less than enthused, Kate. I can't tell. Or is that a sharp intake of breath of excitement?
No, that's me trying to, like, I subscribe to Cooking Light magazine, which is a great resource for making healthy food. Mm-hmm. And they have been pushing cricket flour for a while. And it's like one of those things where it just doesn't.
Hey, hold on.
Wait, cricket flour. Yeah, flour made from like ground up crickets.
Sure. Like, if I take like a chair and grind it up, do I have chair flour? Like. Well, that's not a thing. I don't think this is how it works. When you cremate a body, that's not like human flour. This is not how it works. You can't. Flour is from specific things, Kate. We have rules in our society. In our cosmic existence, there are clear guidelines and crickets are not flour.
Well, I take it up with the fine people at Cooking Light, but
I may write a strongly worded letter.
For some reason, cricket flour is something that I'm like, I could probably get behind that, but I just found out they're chapulines.
Okay.
Chapulines, the bowl, like the thrifty side of me appreciates the $4 price tag. The ecologically conscious side of me appreciates that very much. This is kind of where our food, as you know, usable land shrinks, and we move away from like an animal-based diet towards a more plant-based diet. It's a very cheap source of protein. I know that they're eaten all over the world. I want to get behind it so badly, but every time I see it, I just think legs.
I think they're going to be delicious. I've already made a deal with one of our fellow writers, new intern Adam Gresh, that we're going to split a bowl of them on opening day. So Henry, I think they're going to be great. And if you are at a game and I see you, I will happily share a few of them with you.
I will try one. But I don't like crawfish either because of it's a legs thing. It's legs. I can't.
I'm not saying it's not gross, but that could be crunchy. That's a crunchy snack, and I look forward to it. Love a good exoskeleton.
You know. All right. Let's move on. All right.
Next question from Alex On at Alex On OD. Why am I nervous? And also, would you move Haniger down the lineup to ease the pressure on him?
Let me just pull an answer to why am I nervous out of my Cards of Humanity deck. Cards Against Humanity deck.
Excellent.
We're all nervous. I mean, you don't want to start the season 1-3. You don't want to start the season with your big boppers not bopping bigly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, of course. Of course.
I believe Plato said that. there's plenty to be worried about, you know. Felix looking good and then getting hurt, even if it appears to be in an extremely minor and non-long-term way. Just none of that inspired confidence. And I think seeing, you know, we have flashbacks to the dark years of 2010 through 2013 where the offense just looked miserable and, seeing the pitching staff come, you know, have four great starts, three of which essentially were wasted. You know, that's nerve-wracking. But I think as you said, the big boppers are going to bop. And if they don't, then we're screwed anyway. So, exactly. You know, so I don't know. I guess I'm not concerned about that, just because there were so many different decisions that we could have made or could not have made. And, like, you know, this is going to be a team that needs Robinson Cano to be good. And that if he's not, that's kind of, you know, all of the rest of the stuff that we're worrying about is pointless. So it's the lack of any alternatives in that way make it less stressful to me, I guess, because it's so completely more than all of this is out of our control. That in particular is out of anyone's control.
All right.
Would you move Haniger down the lineup to ease the pressure on him? Sorry, I went off on a bit and we missed the second part of that.
That's
question.
All right. I was trying to hold that in my mind so I wouldn't forget it. But No, I think that they're pretty. I think they're pretty committed to Haniger. You're the dude. So I had many people in my mentions on Monday night. Mm-hmm. Asking why we did not pinch hit for Haniger, which of course leads me to the question, who?
Yes.
I mean, I'm as big of a Taylor Motter fan as anyone, but that's kind of a tough ask.
For sure. Yeah. And this ties in actually to our next question from Brian DeGry at Brian D85, which wasn't there a time where it was an option of Dyson hitting first and Segura hitting second or vice versa? So sort of the top of the order obviously has changed a little bit at the end of spring training, and that is an interesting point there.
I think that they just, with Dyson's potential health concerns with the legs, and you know, he just doesn't have a ton of pop in the bat. You can see... Mm-hmm. He's going to hit one every so often, but it's not, he's not the dependable source of power / ability to take a walk that I think Haniger offers.
Yeah, I agree. I think, I know the initial reasoning was that Dyson had a little stretch where he was feeling, I think, a little bit tired. His legs were just a little bit, I think, maybe sore from overexertion after the off season or whatever it may have been. So they gave him a little bit of time off and they decided to start him out lower in the order as a result. But I agree, sort of, as you said, Dyson has elite speed. But he generally isn't an extraordinary on base percentage guy. You know, he's a fine hitter, but he's always going to be below average. He's been a below average hitter his entire career. And his value comes from when he gets on the bases and when he is in the outfield. And so I actually love him at the bottom of the order, where if he gets on base, he can steal a base when Gene Segura is up, or he can get from first to third on a Gene Segura single. You know, Segura being our best contact hitter. So I think that's actually a really great, you know, really fantastic turn around of the order. And Haniger has a little more pop, yeah, and he also generally has a better on-base percentage, I think.
It's also really fun to have him as a spark at the bottom of the lineup, as you were saying, like, if he does get on base. Because one person that I didn't give any negativity towards, but really looked rough this season or this series stretch, was Leonis Martin.
Just, yeah.
Wow, some really, really bad at bats. I don't know if he's
bad, and he looked frustrated.
Yeah,
and understandably
frustrated. His bat into the ground and broke it.
Yeah, and you know, some of that was, you know, he had I think at least one, maybe two line drives that were hard that were right at people, but he looked bad, and he won't look that bad the entire time, but especially if he is more the Leonis Martin from the later half of the season and less the one that he was before he was hurt last year. It's going to be important to have Dyson, yep. you know, to have people who are getting on base and not striking out all the time. And I think Dyson being on base in front of Segura there is a nice thing. Our next questions, series of questions, come from Whiskey Rick at Whiskey Rick on Twitter. And he
you have to read these in a Scottish accent because Ricky's Scottish.
Good Lord. Well, sorry, Whiskey, because I mix up Scottish and pirate and Jenna. Why are the nope, that's Irish. Why are the Crawford boxes a thing?
That's definitely pirate.
It could be. It could be.
Okay, that's Jamaican.
Why are the Crawford boxes a thing?
That seems a little better.
Thank you.
All right. The Crawford boxes are a thing because life is pain.
Do you know the history of the Crawford boxes or why they are an important thing or anything about them?
I don't. And for a long time, I was calling them the crawfish boxes.
Right. After the SBN site.
No, I just called them that before
you had a predetermined, excellent.
Yeah. Well, they're named that because they're parallel to Crawford Street, which is an appropriately banal explanation for an appropriately banal stadium.
Love it. Love it. Here's what I will say. I love quirky stadiums. My dad grew up telling me stories about going to see games at the Polo Grounds and, you know, the 260-foot foul lines with 480 feet in center field and just nonsense.
Nonsense.
It's like, you look at home run numbers from back then, and then you remember that half of the fields were like 280 feet down, down the lines, and it's like, oh, okay, Jimmy Fox, cool. you were swinging a 50-pound, a 50-ounce bat and just sticking, hitting pop-ups, like, sweet. But, I hate that they are such a detriment to the Mariners in how they're constructed. But I love erratically constructed stadiums. And one of my favorite things about baseball is that there is no uniformity to how fields are designed. And that it is sort of this built-in expression of personality. The ivy on the walls and the big monster or the green monster, the big monster, But just all of these different things are things that I love about baseball. So, yeah, I hate when George Springer pops a ball up into them, but I don't know. Where do you stand on the Crawford boxes? Dang it! And erratic stadium quirks.
I love things that are quirky. I just hate everything about having to go to Texas and play there and the Astros, so... And it's $37 to sit out there. That's so much money for an outfield seat.
Wow.
37.
It is. I mean, it is interesting that you could, I guess, if you sat on the far left side, you could catch a ball. I've wondered about this. Has there ever been a ball that flew over the Crawford boxes but then landed in play? Like, landed, like, hit that wall that's behind it. Because they jut out at slightly diagonal angle, right? So you could theoretically hit a ball that, if you hit it a little bit softer, would have been a homer, but ends up being a double.
Because it bounces off the dumb wall.
Because it goes too far. Yeah, because you hit it too far, and it went over the edge of the stands and into fair play again. Like, I don't think there's anywhere else in
baseball
where that's
the case. My guess is,
I
think there's a stripe, so if it goes over the stripe, doesn't it?
Yes, that's the case, but I don't think they have, maybe. I don't know.
Can I also point out that if you sit in the Crawford boxes, apparently you get a gift, and you catch a home run, you get a gift certificate to Rainforest Cafe, because that seems horribly horrible.
God, Houston. All right, All right. Next question from Whisker Rick. Will Nelson Cruz ever make contact again?
Oh, you're getting better. Yes.
I did it. I had a D&D campaign with a friend of mine who is Scottish and insisted on speaking in a Scottish accent. So I'm harkening back to that.
Very good.
Interesting experience. So.
Yes. Next question.
He'll be fine. Who possesses the more dashingly handsome smile, Kano or Segura?
It's got to be Kano. Nobody has as beautiful a smile as Robbie does. There's something about when Robinson Cano smiles that, like, it just feels like it should be accompanied with, like, a tiny cherubim on either side of his face.
I see, but I think Segura, that's the difference, because Segura is the cherubim. I think Segura is both cherubim. Like, his smile is just this, like, playful, he's like a puck kind of character, whereas, like...
Very impish.
Yeah, Cano is
the hero.
Exactly, Cano's the suave hero, and Segura is the lovable trickster, the Peter Pan kind of joy. So, I think that would be. I'm glad we're on the same page.
Oh,
there.
Definitely.
All right, Neil Posner at NJ Posner asks: is there a worse city in the United States than Houston?
I mean. There's probably another town in Texas that can take that. Texas sucks.
Have you ever been to Houston?
Yes, but only just kind of through it. I can't remember if I was just going through... I can't remember if it was in a car or in a plane that I went through it. But it is an endless stretch of just kind of dry and gray. It's like concrete and then just like...
Absolutely. Nothingness.
So
I'm glad to hear you say that because I have one positive about Houston, which is that it's where Scarface is from and he is one of my favorite musical artists, so I can't hate it too much. However, the only time I've been to Houston was when I was very young and we were flying there. I think we had a layover on our way to Florida to visit grandparents, and I remember landing there after growing up in Seattle, and I was 6 years old, and I did not understand where the trees were, because everything was brown and yellow and death and dying, and there was no shade, and I didn't understand why there wasn't any shade. So maybe there is, but not one I've been to, even briefly.
Yeah, Oklahoma is not a great state. I will say that. Oklahoma is really boring. But Oklahoma at least has, like, some hills, some interest. Texas is just flat. Inconclusive, but we are strongly leaning towards yes.
It's a strong hypothesis. All right, our final set of questions here from Bevel Apologist at PA... Or P. Alexif, Peter, I believe. Two questions.
Still one, stuck in the Seahawks season, I see, Peter.
Indeed, he does need a lot of apologizing. What do you think the Mariners' record will be at the end of April? That is our first task here. I don't know. It's tough. I mean, they've obviously not started out very well. They have a pretty tough slate, honestly. With 7 games against Houston, 3 games against Texas, and they end April with a 3-game series against Cleveland. The only team that you look at and say that team's supposed to not be very good this year is Oakland in a 4-game series, and they're not even at home. So,
yeah, and Oakland is sneakily good.
Yeah, they're obnoxious.
They are so obnoxious. Ryan Healy is obnoxious, although I've been saying for a long time that I think he's good and was shouted down by smart baseball people. I'm definitely talking about Zach Sanders.
I was going to say, you're sub-potting Zach Sanders.
I'm sub-potting Zach Sanders.
He's, I think, an obnoxious hitter that's going to hit. He's going to take Chris Davis's mantle, except Chris Davis is still there, so
yeah.
They're just going to be obnoxious together.
I mean, it's hard to say, but I think we match up okay against Los Angeles.
Uh-huh.
We also miss Garrett Richards and Tyler Skaggs, who got lit up anyway. So I think 2 out of 3 is possible there. I think Houston's going to be tough again. I think we'd be lucky to get 2 there.
Yep.
Texas hasn't looked great out of the gate here.
Yeah, and they're still down half their pitching staff.
Yeah.
So it's nice to get a little bit of a chance to jump on them early, along with LA.
I think the only real good potential for a sweep on the schedule is Miami. Mm-hmm. I think we could do some damage. I watched them yesterday, and their pitching staff is meh. And yeah,
they've got a good bullpen, but their
infield is,
you
know, they've got Stanton, and that's yeah. I think there's a good shot there. I think Oakland, we probably come out better than. I've been watching Detroit for some reason. I've watched a lot of Detroit games lately. I don't know why. They're just always on when I turn on MLB Network while I'm like doing something else in the background. It's always Detroit lately. They don't look super great, although Verlander and Fulmer, if we get Verlander and Fulmer, that's going to be tough, especially if the bats haven't quite woken up yet. And then Cleveland is going to be really hard. So I would be really happy with them just ending April 500, but I wouldn't be totally surprised to see them a few games under that.
Yeah, I think so. We have 26 games in April. I'm sort of with you. I think they'll be around, you know, 14 and 12, 15 and 11, 13 and 13. So, you know, somewhere in that range.
So you think they'll be over 500?
I think they'll be around 500, and maybe narrowly above, just because Texas and the Angels are both still kind of getting healthy. And
Beltre's still out, right?
Yes, yeah. Beltre's still on the DL, and I'm pretty down on the Tigers, so I think that's a good shot. But again, you know, 3 games at Cleveland doesn't sound like fun at any point in time.
No.
So, yeah. Thankfully, the schedule opens up a lot more in May. But I think it's going to be a big thing for this team to be, you know, retain composure and you know, be able to adjust.
Can we also talk about? Sorry. Can we also talk about how rough of an entry this is? 10 straight games against. 7 of them against Houston. I mean, that's brutal.
It's
before
brutal.
You have even a day off. That is a brutal stretch. And then another big long stretch. 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Another 10 in a row. So, woof, that's a grind.
I think the mentality should be survive April and thrive in May.
Survive April, thrive in May. I like it. It's catchy. Let's run with it.
All right. Final question of the afternoon. What will the batting average with runners in scoring position be by the end of the month? So right now we are...
Oh, who gave you that question, by the way?
That is also from Peter.
Oh, okay.
So... Right now, we are sitting at, let me make sure I've got this properly up here, a cool 083. Love it. Not actually last in the league.
Who is last?
Only 28. The Phillies with a nice 059.
Oh, jeez.
But they have had less than half as many plate appearances with runners in scoring position. And actually... If you want to look at the positive, the Mariners are 3rd in the league in plate appearances with runners in scoring position. So, yeah, it's been frustrating.
At some point, the dam will break, and we will start getting those guys in.
Indeed. And so I think to sort of tie that around, I think it'll be up to about league average. I think it'll be around 280, 290, and should be actually above average this year simply because they're an above average hitting team. And I don't know, Kate, what do you think?
I would like to believe that. I am concerned about holes in the lineup. I'm concerned about Martin. I'm concerned about Valencia and ugly plate appearances, which is something that I thought we were going to get rid of when we got rid of Ketel Marte and Adam Lind. Yeah.
And we did. And we did get, you know, in terms of filling those holes, one for two. The plate appearances and positions we filled are actually, I think, pretty good. The plate appearances in players that we thought would continue to have good plate appearances, a little shaky.
Oh, and, you know, Mike Zunino doesn't have a ton to show for his plate appearances in the Houston series, but he really had some good ones.
Yeah, I think he looked fine. And what I saw from Zunino made me feel fine that, you know, he's not going to be, you know,
he's not an auto out.
He's not going to break into Buster Posey. But yeah, but it's sort of the, I have instinctively built up an expectation that, oh, it's a curveball that starts at the knees. That's going to be a strike because he's going to swing at it. So perhaps I'm a little bit overly excited every time he doesn't do something terrible. But when you have the power that he does simply by not doing terrible things more often, he allows himself the opportunity to do to maximize his skill set. So that is encouraging.
Do terrible things less often. I can't believe that didn't get chosen as the slogan for the team this year.
Whatever it takes, do terrible things less often. It's about the same. So I want to leave you with a fun, maybe fun, little comparison here, because there's been a lot of talk about the Mariners and how they historically are atrocious with runners in scoring position and how they have really struggled. And I think, you know, obviously right now, they, through 41 plate appearances and four games, are sitting at a negative 14 WRC plus in those situations, which is no, I don't want to do that. But I think it's worth looking at similar, at this team historically, which is not necessarily predictive, especially the further we go back, but is more indicative of where this mentality, I think, has come from and why we should be a little bit more laid back, perhaps. So this very simple game, we're going to go back for the last couple of years, and I want you to tell me where you think the team ranked in terms of WRC plus with runners in scoring position. So we'll start with last year. Where do you think they ranked in the league?
I think they were good. I'm going to say...
You can give me a top. You can give me a range.
I'm going to say top half, definitely, and maybe just outside of the top 10. Mm-hmm.
So they were tied for sixth in the league.
Oh, wow.
In terms of WRC plus with runners in scoring position. And again, I should preface this all by saying, generally, hitting with runners in scoring position is not a skill that has been proven to be different than hitting generally, but there is this mentality, I think, that the Mariners inherently are bad at it. So I wanted to look back at how they actually have been. So being one of, you know, in the top 10, sixth in the league with a 106 WRC plus, pretty solid.
That's good.
2015. Not the greatest year for the Mariners as an organization. Perhaps they were struggling in this area as well. Kate, I believe you wrote actually a little bit about this. So maybe you have a general frame of where they might be coming in this.
Yeah, I think I was interested in the Edgar effect, the so-called Edgar effect. And I believe I looked at this and saw that they had taken a pretty dramatic spike upwards after he came on, but and also in on-base percentage too, which was something else I was looking at. But they were pretty, I don't know how much the Edgar effect saw them through to the end of the year, so let's say, I don't know, 23rd.
They were 27th. And they
so close
were, yes, not
for me. Not for them.
Particularly close. No, or close for you. Yeah, but and similar to that point, I'm not looking at the splits during the season, but they were second to last in the league in on base percentage in these situations with 309. They had an 86 WRC plus in 2015. So,
ow.
Yes, a bad year. So top 10 last year, bottom 5 2 years ago. 2014, another good season for the Mariners. Where do you think they rank?
That was a good season, but I still don't believe that that was a particularly good team.
Indeed.
I think
they
were
had a mentality, right, of being sort of the solo run.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, Masters. Oh, that's right.
Solo homer, Masters.
I would like to put them around in the 20s as well, I think. Maybe right at 20.
They were 6th in the league again.
Really?
Indeed. Oh. We cannot be ruled by our memories and the things they cling to. They betray us every time.
Well, that's a good lesson.
In fairness, their on-base percentage was actually 20th in the league there. Oh. But they had a knack for power and a knack for getting hits. So in the last 3 years, essentially, the Mariners have been a top 10 team, top 6 team in the league in WRC Plus with runners in scoring position. So the last thing I will point to, and I understand, obviously, why many Mariners fans are upset and still have lingering pain, is that from 2010 to 2013, the Mariners were the worst team in the league for hitting with runners in scoring position. They were one of the worst teams in the league at hitting in general, but over 5,800 plate appearances, they had an 83 WRC+.
Oh, that's bad.
And yes, it was worst in the league. They were the worst by pretty much every hitting metric. So I understand those scars. At the same time, the only two hitting or position players still on the roster from the 2013 team are Kyle Seager and Mike Zunino. So it's a different team. It's a different mentality. It's a different different mindset. It is not the same old M's. And maybe this team will continue to hit poorly with runners in scoring position, but they have good players and players that have no connection to those teams that disappointed us for so long. So judge them on their own merits, I guess, is where I'm at.
Well, that is a very good lesson, I think, and a good way to leave off for this particular episode. So
absolutely.
This has been the Lookout Landing podcast. Thank you so much for those of you who have listened, and we will catch you next week. Go M's.
Go M's.
It's what they need. It's nothing. East Coast to West Coast. It's nothing. They got it's for what it is. It's nothing. Cross seas worldwide, baby. Hey yo, we stuck in the time of drought. Nothing to rhyme about. Ghetto with crime on the grind, pulling iron out. Industry crying out, major labels buying now. Who put the fire out? Real hip hop is dying now. Sound like the perfect time for us. Set off the new beginning. Let me.